going on in Malaya right now. Vietnam might be next. Wake up, Margaret. It's simply astounding to me that people like you can literally almost be killed by Reds one minute, and the next minute you're essentially defending them, Carlin said. You're the one reciting their mottos, Margaret said. We're not defending communists, said Charlie. We're objecting to you killing innocent people, whether in Malaya or here in the States. None of the problems here in the U.S. are intentional, said Strongfellow. At least, the livestock incident in my district in Skull Valley was an accident. Chemical spill.
Oh, dear sweet Strongfellow, said Street. None of this is an accident. They're testing how effective these poisons are. On animals in Utah and on poor folk, whether blacks in Louisiana or whites in Appalachia. No one introduces a product to the market without vigorous testing.
We've told General Kinetics to change that, said Carlin. They're moving the testing to Mexico and India.
So the Hellfire Club had Van Wagenen killed before he could come forward with any of this, Charlie, Street said. He was starting to figure it out. What they didn't know is that Van Wagenen and McLaughlin were working together. And after Van Wagenen was killed, Mac kept going.
But didn't the Puerto Ricans kill Mac? Asked Strongfellow, clearly the most confused person in the room.
Don't be a fool, Carlin said. It's not as if we wanted him dead and got lucky. There's no such thing as lucky. There's what we do and what we fail to do.
I don't understand, said Charlie. Street chuckled.
So, Charlie, let's imagine that Chairman Carlin is a powerful member of a secret society, an association that includes the FBI director as a member, an FBI director with paid informants everywhere, one who might have inside knowledge of the Puerto Rican nationalists' plot to shoot up the Capitol ahead of time. And then let's imagine that in the midst of that shootout, a congressman who was a thorn in the side of the secret society, who was threatening to expose a company run by another member of that club, just happens to get shot and killed.
Carlin shook his head admiringly at Street. I'd have to be some kind of goddamn genius to pull off what you're insinuating.
See now, Street said with a smile, you're not so modest after all. It's too bad they don't give Pulitzers for assassinations.
All the things we do to keep this nation safe from the kinds of Reds who tried to kill Margaret just a few hours ago, Carlin said. And still these idiots don't get it.
We get it, said Margaret, but General Kinetics is killing Americans in the process.
Look, said Carlin, in retrospect, could our friends at General Kinetics have exercised more caution, spent more money on safety measures and such? I suppose, but it would have slowed down production, like with the need to rush gas masks to the front lines. As we said, omelets, eggs, you know.
I do indeed, Charlie said grimly, fists clenched at his sides.
And who won the war, Charlie? Asked Carlin.
Those of us who actually fought in the war didn't have this in mind, Charlie said.
Carlin frowned theatrically, looking doubtful. Oh, really? He said. Street fought in that war. Strongfellow fought in that war.
You sure about that? Charlie asked.
Aha! Carlin said, almost pleased. So you're not a perfect angel. You read this is your life's investigation into Strongfellow here, the one you stole from your father.
What?
Strongfellow asked. The file we have on you proving that you never served with the OSS, Carlin said. Charlie purloined that from his father. His dad is a lawyer, does work for NBC, and they found out right before your episode of This Is Your Life aired, the one that shared the story of your glorious, if entirely concocted, heroism. They buried it, Charlie's dad had it, Charlie stole it, and here we are.
You son of a bitch, Strongfellow said to Charlie.
That true?
Charlie winced and turned his head around to look at Strongfellow.
I did it for the same reason you're presumably doing this, Charlie said. I thought they had dirt on me. Turns out it was all a setup that I didn't do what they told me I'd done. But in any case, yes, I swiped the NBC investigation from my dad's office.
Ooh-wee, exclaimed Street. What does it say?
It goes into detail about how for the entire war, Strongfellow was a machinist. Stateside. There's a letter from Dulles stating he was never OSS. Letter from the Pentagon saying he was never overseas.
Strongfellow appeared to be grinding his teeth.
Why'd NBC run the episode then? Street asked.
You'd have to ask them why they sat on it, Charlie said. I assume ratings, currying favor with Republicans. Are the presidents of the networks in the Hellfire Club?
Carlin turned to Street and waved a hand in Charlie's direction. We need to wrap this up, Mr. Street.
That's fine, said Street, but I'm not going to clean up any messes.
Of course not, Carlin said.
That's what Catherine's henchmen over there are for, Street said, drawing angry glares again.
Charlie looked straight ahead at Margaret, her arms bound behind her back, her face a mask of pure panic.
At what point does your construction of this Potemkin village start undermining your ability to build the actual village? Charlie asked. If your leaders are frauds like Strongfellow and demagogues like McCarthy, at what point do they supplant real leaders? At what point are you killing and hurting more Americans than you're saving?
Be quiet, instructed Carlin. You hold no cards here.
So who else is in the Hellfire Club? Asked Margaret.
They're just stalling, Frank, Leopold said.
Mr. Street, Carlin said. Tick-tock.
Street gripped Strongfellow's 38 with two hands and began to raise it.
Mr. Chairman, Charlie asked, can I at least kiss my wife one last time?
Oh, sweet baby Jesus, said Leopold. She took a gun out of her jacket pocket.
I'll shoot him if you need me to.
The two men standing with her took their guns out of their jackets, presumably in case their services were required as well.
Go ahead and kiss her, Charlie, Street said. Make it quick.
Charlie raised his hands in surrender and slowly walked over to Margaret, looking at Carlin for the okay. Carlin nodded. Her eyes were wild with fear and fury.
Charlie, she said. They...
He lowered his hands and silenced her with a kiss, feeling her angry resistance until he broke away to whisper in her ear. She swallowed and nodded. They kissed each other again, tenderly. Charlie then turned to Street, his hands back up near the sides of his head.
Okie doke, Isaiah, he said.
Street nodded, aimed a gun at Charlie.
Okie doke, Charlie, Street said.
Roger,
Charlie said.
Shoot him already, Carlin said.
Three, said Street.
Oh, good Lord, said Leopold.
Two, Street continued.
Love you, honey,
said Margaret.
Love you too, baby, said Charlie.
And, said Street.
At the last second, Charlie and Margaret dropped to the ground, while Street simultaneously turned his aim from Charlie toward the two thugs standing with Leopold.
Two shots were fired, and the two thugs dropped to the ground. Leopold gasped.
Carlin exclaimed, What the fuck?
And jumped behind a sculpture of Crispus Attucks, a split second before Street turned 180 degrees and shot at him. Lying on her back on the floor, Margaret pulled the hoop of her bound arms under her rear and her legs to bring her hands in front of her. It was a struggle, given her pregnant belly, but her adrenaline and flexibility made it work. Leopold fired at Street. She missed, but she got his attention. He returned fire, and Leopold ran behind a statue of Charles Lindbergh, holding an America First banner. Leopold, using the statue for cover, fired at Street from the far side of the tribute to Lindbergh, and Margaret crawled around the other side. Focused on Street, Leopold didn't notice Margaret creeping up and looping her arms over her head and around her neck. Margaret pulled back with all her might. Leopold gasped for air and dropped her gun as she struggled to insert her hand between Margaret's bound wrists and her own neck. Charlie ran to Strongfellow and squared up against him, but before he could punch him, Strongfellow kicked him in the groin. Charlie fell on the ground in agony. Strongfellow began kicking him in the gut, his legs very obviously perfectly functioning. The image of Margaret and their baby sprang into Charlie's head. He lunged for Strongfellow's legs and knocked him down. Strongfellow's head hit the floor hard as Street ran over and began kicking him in the stomach.
Isaiah! Charlie yelled.
Carlin was pushing a statue of General George Custer onto them. Charlie shoved Street out of the way. The statue hit Charlie's back. Custer's arm broke off its body and smashed into Strongfellow's head, knocking him out. Charlie cried out in pain. Margaret was still locked in battle with Leopold, her wrists still bound and around Leopold's neck. Leopold, demonstrating surprising strength as she struggled mightily to free herself, began bucking like a bronco, first pulling Margaret forward and lifting her off her feet, then suddenly running backward and ramming Margaret into a statue of Supreme Court Justice Roger Taney. Margaret was terrified but couldn't let go, since her wrists remained bound, and the more Leopold battered Margaret, the tighter Margaret hung on, strangling her. Street checked on the two thugs to make sure they were dead, then raced to Charlie's side to help him. But Charlie, teeth clenched in agony, shook his head. Go help Margaret! Street did, but not before slamming his OSS gun into the palm of Charlie's hand. Street turned toward Margaret as Carlin emerged from the crowd of statues, bent down to the base of a figure of Continental Army General Charles Lee, and tried to topple it onto Charlie. Lee teetered, and Charlie managed to push himself out of its way a moment before the stone mass fell onto the space he had just occupied.
Hands on his knees, gasping, Charlie found the OSS gun on the ground and aimed it right at Carlin.
"That's a single shot, Charlie," Street called. "You can't miss."
Charlie aimed for Carlin's head. Carlin's eyes widened.
"No," Carlin said. "Wait, Charlie, listen to me."
Charlie fired, but the Liberator was a gun for emergencies, and Charlie reverted to his basic training mistake of flinching as he anticipated the gun's recoil. The bullet whizzed past Carlin's head and hit the statue of Crispus Attucks. Carlin jumped forward onto Charlie and grabbed his throat, then tried to shove his thumbs into Charlie's eyes. Charlie pulled at Carlin's wrists, trying to stop the pain. Carlin's obvious desperation seemed to empower him, but he was also much older and weaker than his adversary. Charlie, in pain, kicked Carlin in the groin, then twisted Carlin's wrist and slammed his forehead into the older man's nose. Carlin coughed and released his grip. Charlie threw him to his right. Carlin grabbed at Charlie's arm and bit it. Charlie screamed as Carlin's teeth broke the skin. Feeling a white-hot jolt of fury, Charlie grabbed Carlin by his shirt collar and lifted him off the ground, then turned his body to the left and slammed the man's head into the sharp corner of the base of the Crispus Attucks statue. It might as well have been the edge of an axe. The marble edge was now marked with a deep crimson stain as all fight left Carlin's body. He groaned and his eyes rolled back in his head. It was at precisely that moment that Leopold succumbed to Margaret's bound hands around her neck. She dropped to her knees, then fell onto her face, dragging Margaret along with her. Charlie stood, ran to Margaret, extricated her from the death trap she had fastened around Leopold's neck, and embraced her. The room was suddenly still, the only sound Margaret, Charlie, and Street breathing heavily. They were surrounded by their fallen enemies, one unconscious, one dying, three dead.
"I told you I was on your side," Street finally said.
Chapter 29. Thursday, April 22nd, 1954. Morning. Capitol Hill. Three men in suits, Colt 38s in hand, walked into the storage room. They all looked alike. Brown hair, mid-30s, trim builds, dark suits. Secret Service, maybe, or FBI. Their exact affiliation was unclear.
"Nice timing," said Street,
hands braced on his knees, dripping with sweat and breathing like Jesse Owens after a wind sprint. "Is everyone okay?" one of the men asked.
"We're fine," said Charlie, holding Margaret, his hand on her pregnant belly. "Everyone's good."
Margaret's face was buried in his chest. "You should vamoose," the third man said to Street. "We'll take care of it from here." Street nodded and motioned to Charlie and Margaret to follow him. They reached the hallway and paused.
"Who were they?"
Charlie asked.
"The good guys," said Street.
"Do you know the way out?"
Margaret asked.
"Out of the basement or the situation?"
"Either," she said.
"Basement, yes."
"And the situation here?
Three dead bodies and two sitting congressmen knocked out, all in the basement of the U.S. Capitol?"
Street shook his head.
"That one's a little trickier."
Outside, a bright dawn was breaking as if the sun were proud to be seen after days hiding. Charlie heard mourning doves coo and could smell the earthy, loamy scent of spring. A bus drove up Constitution Avenue. The city was starting to stir. A red Cadillac Coupe de Ville sat in the Capitol driveway, its engine running. Charlie peered in and saw Senator Kefauver behind the wheel, a grim expression on his face. Winston Martyr was in the back seat.
"Get in,"
Winston said.
"Margaret, honey, you sit up front."
"Please hurry," said Kefauver. "We need to get..."
"I love it when you pretend you're a hillbilly,"
gruffed Winston.
The three piled into the Cadillac and Kefauver hit the gas and took a right out of the Capitol driveway onto Independence Avenue. The atmosphere inside the car was tense. They rode in silence for a few blocks, Kefauver and Charlie scanning the surroundings for a tail. Finally, Margaret turned around from the front seat to face the men.
"That's all going to be cleaned up?" Margaret asked Winston.
"Area will be secured and cleaned," he said.
"We left behind maybe four dead bodies, including the House Appropriations Committee chairman," Charlie said.
"However many you left behind, and whoever they are, it will be taken care of," said Winston.
He turned to Street.
"Four dead bodies, including Carlin?"
"Yeah, it got ugly," said Street, who took a few minutes to explain everything that had happened since he last saw Winston a day before in Manhattan.
Margaret filled in other blanks, describing Gwinnett's menacing hunt for her and how Catherine Leopold killed him.
"Good Christ," Winston finally said. "I'm so sorry, Margaret. I never wanted you to get caught up in any of this. I never wanted Charlie to get caught up in it.
Then why arrange for me to get the congressional seat? Charlie asked, a note of irritation in his voice. Or at the very least, why not tell me about everything that was going on so I could have a better way to protect Margaret and the baby?
We didn't know, Charlie, Street said. I can defend myself, Isaiah, Winston said.
I know, Street said, but Charlie, you need to understand, we've only been about a half step ahead of you. We didn't even know about the car accident until you told me.
I had no idea you were going to be pulled into any of this when I got Dewey to give you the seat, and I certainly didn't know you were going to pull that foolish stunt at the comic book hearing, Winston said. That's what escalated everything. Until then, the Hellfire Club thought they had you where they wanted you, and until then, Estes and Isaiah were keeping me abreast of everything. We all were doing everything we could to steer you away from the Hellfire Club.
Except for telling me about it, of course, Charlie said.
You were supposed to just do your job, Winston said. You weren't supposed to take on the whole goddamn system, or screw with Carlin, or steal papers from my goddamn study.
You knew about that? Charlie asked.
After the fact, Winston said. Dulles told me. That poor miserable son of a bitch Strongfellow is going to be ruined. Not by me. By the club. Especially now, tied to this mess. Poor Sap probably thinks he's in the clear.
Wait. You're going to let him loose after he tried to kill me?
That's how this works, Charlie, Winston said. We don't call the police on one another. We bribe the police to stay out of it. The FBI or Secret Service swoops in and cleans everything up. Our organizations don't play by the normal rules.
We? What organizations besides the Hellfire Club? Margaret asked.
Who is we? The, Loose Association that I'm in, Winston said, and Isaiah.
What is this Loose Association? Margaret asked. Central Intelligence? FBI? I don't understand.
You will soon enough, but I've said all I can, Winston said.
Margaret, surely you realize that clandestine services in the U.S. are made up not only of organizations you know about, but also ones you don't, Street offered. They stopped at a red light. No one spoke. The light changed and they drove on in uncomfortable silence. I assume you can tell us about the Hellfire Club at least, Margaret asked. Who are they?
We don't know anything for sure, Winston said. We think its monks include Carlin, Hilton, McCarthy, the Dulles boys, Hoover, Ambassador Kennedy, who else?
Duncan Whitney from General Kinetics, Street said. We don't know them all. You got closer to the club, Charlie, than I ever could.
And what do they do? Margaret asked.
Control almost everything, said Kefauver.
Make a lot of money, Street said. They all have networks of people who owe them favors or people they've compromised, Winston said. And yes, they're getting rich, but they're also fighting commies.
They contain multitudes, Street said, smiling at Charlie.
Charlie, after your run-in with McCarthy and Cohn at Connie Hilton's party, we think you had an even bigger target on your back, Winston said. Carlin was already chomping at the bit to get you in line, but that was to control you, not kill you.
And that was the night Charlie was set up, Margaret realized.
Indeed, said Winston. Carlin got his henchmen to arrange that whole thing. The knockout drug, the staged accident. But we didn't know any of that until just recently. I begged Alan Dulles for help. Turned out he'd had you tailed that night and had the photos that cleared you.
But we didn't find out until yesterday, Street said, right before I brought them to you.
Alan's a cagey bastard, and he wouldn't just turn anything over. Now I owe him.
What do we need to do to make sure they don't try to kill us again? Margaret asked.
That was just Carlin and his team, Winston Martyr said. Not the whole club, but you need to drop the General Kinetics thing.
Drop it? Charlie said, alarmed.
We think the club is in factions right now, Street said. They're being torn apart over McCarthy. Kennedy brought McCarthy into the club in 49. He got McCarthy to agree not to campaign against Jack during his Senate run 3 years later. They've all been allies.
But McCarthy since then has gone nuts, Kefauver added.
There's a struggle going on in the club, Winston said. They all see McCarthy is out of control and needs to be stopped before he takes on Ike in 56. The Dulles brothers and some of the generals and CEOs are looking to end the problem. It may prove easier for him to be hoisted with his own petard.
We suspect a few defense contractor CEOs are monks or second-tier abbots, Street said. They want the enormous defense contracts to proceed, and McCarthy's focus on the army is causing them huge problems.
McCarthy smeared General Marshall back in 1950. They thought he was going to stop there,
Margaret asked.
Gotta hit the rat on the head the moment he pokes his head out of the sewer, Charlie agreed.
But that holds true for General Kinetics too, Dad.
That's nonsense,
Winston said angrily.
The chemical weapons program is vital. The Hellfire Club isn't wrong about that.
The Reds are a menace, Charlie, Street said.
Look at how they manipulated Margaret, sending that zoologist to get close to her with me and you as targets,
Winston said.
You need to stop being naive about the Reds. There are forces at play here that are much bigger than your ideals and the way you think the world should work.
But you're playing by the same corrupt rules as the Hellfire Club, Charlie said. You agree with those rules?
That's like asking if we agree or disagree with oxygen, said Winston. Or the tides.
This is how it works, Street said. I'm quite certain I like it even less than you do, but these are the realities.
General Kinetics is going to change the way they do business, Winston said. And you need to keep your mouth shut. That's non-negotiable.
They sat in silence. Kefauver took a left onto Rock Creek Parkway. Margaret looked out her window at the circular Doric temple that stood just off the road, dedicated on Armistice Day, 1931, by President Hoover, as a tribute to the men and women of Washington, D.C., who had given their lives in the Great War, as if there would never be another. Simpler times, Margaret thought.
It's just stunning that this whole time you and my dad have been working together, Charlie said.
It's even more stunning that he convinced Carlin that he was working for him, Winston observed.
That's actually a good point, Margaret said, turning to look at Street behind her. How did you win the trust of...
She searched for the words.
Of a bunch of old white bigots? Street finished for her.
It's a smart question, Winston said. My daughter-in-law possesses much more intelligence than her husband.
I gave them just enough information to trust me, Street said. Intelligence comes from people of all colors. They might be bigots, but they know that much. Intel comes from Arabs, Africans, Jews, Chinese.
You realize, Charlie, Isaiah was working on trying to learn more about the club long before they set their sights on you, Winston said.
It was your dad's idea originally, Street said. When I came here in January of 53, I pretended to be a willing source for them. Given my background in the OSS, they were interested.
I brought it up to Dulles, who mentioned it to Hoover, Winston said. They wouldn't have invited Isaiah over for supper, but they were happy to take his information. Or have him be a button man to kill you two.
Kefauver sighed impatiently and turned on the radio. Y'all talk too much, he said to himself.
Showdown between Senator McCarthy and the U.S. Army, the announcer said. McCarthy claims the Army is behind a conspiracy to discredit him. And he's right, Kefauver laughed.
They fell silent listening to the news. Kefauver left Rock Creek Parkway and worked his way to Dent Place in Georgetown through tree-lined streets where young lawyers and secretaries briskly walked to bus stops.
Here we are,
Winston said, clearly relieved to be pulling up to Charlie and Margaret's townhouse. Winston patted his son on the knee.
Remember what Falstaff said, my son,
Winston said.
The better part of valor is discretion.
But I still have a lot of questions, Charlie said. The other day we stumbled on these documents about the Hellfire Club in England in the 18th century. So Ben Franklin brought it to the U.S.? Street chuckled.
Charlie, we're still trying to figure out everything going on in the club today. We don't even know who all the members are now. We damn sure haven't traced its genealogy.
Legend is that Franklin replicated the club once he returned to the colonies, Winston said. But we don't really know. We're only just now getting a handle on this, thanks to Ike.
Why thanks to Ike? Charlie asked.
You'll see, Winston said. Now please let us go so I can phone Dulles and we can clean this all up.
Margaret opened the car door. It was nice to see you again, Winston, she said dryly, as if they were coming from a mixer and not a fatal shootout. And nice to see you again, Senator Kefauver. It has been way too long since you were kind enough to take us to see the pajama game. We need to repay the favor. Have you over for dinner? Kefauver laughed. She stepped out of the car and straightened her blouse. A passerby would have no idea of the chaotic, bloody night she'd just survived. She leaned toward the passenger window.
And Isaiah, you and Renee need to come over soon, she continued, a caricature of a Georgetown hostess.
Tell her I'll call her. Toodles.
Street grinned. Your wife is crazy, he said to Charlie.
She stood on the sidewalk and looked expectantly at Charlie, who remained in the crowded back seat. Charlie nodded at her, but first turned to his father and said in a low voice so Margaret wouldn't hear.
Are we safe?
Winston hesitated.
I don't know. I don't know who wanted you gone other than Carlin. I assume Hoover and Dulles want this sorry chapter over. You will have to keep your mouth shut about General Kinetics. That's not negotiable.
You need to burn any copies of the Van Wagenen dossier, the info on the chemical plants. You do that, and maybe we can put this all behind us. I'll make some calls as soon as we get to Kefauver's house.
Street opened the back door and stepped out, followed by Charlie. They shook hands.
We'll talk soon, Street said.
I owe you, said Charlie.
I have a feeling I'm going to get a chance to collect, Street said.
Charlie patted Street on the shoulder, then bent down and looked at his father and Kefauver.
Thank you, he said.
You don't need to thank me, Kefauver said. All I did was give the son of an old friend a ride home from Capitol Hill.
Charlie and Margaret walked up the stairs to their front door as Kefauver drove off. Down the street, they could see Senator Kennedy leaving his brownstone, with Jackie fixing the lapels on his sport jacket and kissing him on the cheek. The senator saw Charlie and Margaret, waved, and got into his car. An hour before Charlie and Margaret returned home, LaMontagne was picking the lock of their townhouse, thinking about how much he didn't like killing. The act of ending a life was unpleasant. It was sometimes a physical chore requiring significant exertion, and it was often messy, whether from blood or struggle or end-of-life bodily expulsions. It ticked him off that he'd had to kill the red-headed club cocktail waitress to set up Charlie. Why him? Hadn't he paid his dues by now? Enough already. It made him even angrier when Carlin ordered him to murder Charlie after his stunt at the comic book hearings. LaMontagne thought it beneath his station at this point in his career. Sure, he'd risen quickly in D.C. by being a Mr. Fix-It, but he expected to have graduated from this kind of task by now. LaMontagne had no idea what had happened to Carlin and Leopold in the previous hours, and he was unaware of the saga on Susquehannock Island. All he knew was that the day before, Charlie had been on national television, alluding to national security secrets that the Hellfire Club had already killed two congressmen to conceal. Van Wagenen had been easy. LaMontagne hid in the back seat of the congressman's car, then as soon as he got behind the wheel, out came his Ruger Single Six, bang, a shot to the head. With the help of Abner Lance, they'd staged a murder-suicide with a local prostitute. The cops had been on the scene for only 5 minutes before Hoover's agents arrived and guaranteed the crime would remain unsolved in perpetuity. Offing McLaughlin had been more challenging, given Carlin's scheme to blame it on the Puerto Ricans. One of Hoover's Puerto Rican informants tipped off the Bureau about the attack, and the night before, LaMontagne had planted a rifle under a bench in the House gallery. During the House debate on Mexican migrants, Abner Lance had walked up to the gallery and waited. As soon as the Viva Puerto Rico Libre chant started, Lance, a sniper in the Korean War, aimed at McLaughlin and fired. Amid the chaos, and with every eye focused on the Puerto Ricans on the other end of the gallery, no one saw. The tumblers on the lock gave way. LaMontagne slowly turned the knob and stepped in. Once inside Charlie and Margaret's foyer, LaMontagne closed the door softly and reached to the small of his back to retrieve a pistol he used for these special occasions. A Welrod MK-2A, developed by Station 9 of the UK Special Operations Executive during the war, specifically for assassinations. Quiet, reliable, with no markings. Fewer than 3,000 Welrods had been manufactured. LaMontagne had acquired his through a British friend, a fellow expert in wetwork. The house was silent and dim, the curtains still closed against the daylight. LaMontagne poked his head around the doorways of the downstairs rooms, confirming that they were empty, and then put a tentative foot on the bottom stair, wary of creaks. Cautiously he ascended, placing his weight on the balls of his feet, pausing on each step. He would need to look around the house for a place to hide. Charlie unlocked the door and stepped back to let Margaret enter. Exhausted, they trudged up the two flights of stairs to their bedroom, where Margaret began taking off her flannel and chinos, which had gone from soaking wet to crusted and uncomfortable. Charlie's nostrils flared. Something was wrong. He quickly peered into the walk-in closet and then the bathroom. He dropped down and looked under the bed.
Something wrong, honey?
Charlie approached Margaret and whispered in her ear.
I think Davis LaMontagne is here.
How?
Shh. I smell his cologne.
There was no other explanation for the faint whiff of Cuir de Russie in the air.
He's probably downstairs,
he whispered.
Act normal, and let's be ready.
It was good to see your father,
she finally said aloud.
Yep, Charlie said. Hey, honey, I'm going to take a shower.
He walked into the bathroom and turned on the water. She thought she heard something from the first floor. A step? The creak of a doorknob turning?
Honey, don't use all the shampoo,
she said, struggling to come up with small talk. She tiptoed into the bathroom and whispered to Charlie,
I have an idea.
So do I.
Hiding in the basement, LaMontagne wondered if this had been Charlie's fate from the moment he'd tried to organize the veterans in Congress to defy Carlin over the Goodstone funding. Powerful vectors crush obstructions. The laws of physics are not dissimilar from the rules of man. He could hear Charlie and Margaret talking in their bedroom. LaMontagne began creeping upstairs. As he stepped lightly on the stairs, from the ground floor to the second, the oak beneath his foot emitted a high-pitched creak. LaMontagne froze in place. No one upstairs said anything. Had they heard him? The clanging of pipes and the sound of the shower spray suggested they hadn't. Margaret's voice uttered something. LaMontagne continued his slow trek to the martyr's bedroom. The door to the bedroom was slightly ajar. He pressed himself against the hallway wall and peered carefully into the empty room. Slowly he nudged the door open with his foot and eased his way inside. In the adjoining bathroom to his right, the shower was running. To his immediate left was a door to a walk-in closet. The bed was unmade. LaMontagne steeled himself to kill both Charlie and Margaret. He would make it look like a burglary gone wrong.
Honey, what's the dress at this luncheon?
Margaret's voice suddenly bellowed from behind him, in the closet. She sounded odd, muffled. Maybe she was pulling a shirt over her head? He would dispose of her first. LaMontagne turned around. The door to the walk-in closet was partly closed. He pushed it open with his left hand, his right hand holding the pistol, ready to shoot Margaret where she stood. But the closet was empty. And too late he realized the sound he'd heard was from the baby monitor he'd given them, placed inside the closet. He had been fooled, and that meant Charlie and Margaret. Heat. Intense heat. His head, his hair, and his skin were on fire. He wheeled around and dropped the gun to grab his head with both hands, as if that could quell the pain. Margaret was 10 feet behind him, squirting two different containers at his neck and head. When the chemicals interacted, they formed a weapon that burned LaMontagne's skin. Charlie was to his right, torching him with what felt like a flamethrower, spraying a furniture polish he ignited with his German lighter. LaMontagne was in agony. His body was on fire. He couldn't think past the pain. Margaret opened their bedroom window, and Charlie hoisted him out of it. LaMontagne fell 3 stories and landed on his head. Charlie looked out the window and down onto the brick sidewalk where LaMontagne's body lay, twisted and still on fire. Charlie leaned against the windowsill, his heart pounding.
Okay, he finally said. That worked well.
After they'd called the police, they went to the kitchen and tried to calm down. Charlie boiled water to make them tea. He laid out a small plate of butter cookies, which Margaret began devouring.
Where did you learn that? She asked. With the drain cleaners. How did you know that they would be so dangerous if you combined them? Or that the furniture polish was flammable?
The comic book hearing. Charlie laughed. Good thing for us the nation's comic book publishers offer courses to America's children on how to turn household products into horrific weapons. But it was your idea about the baby monitor that gave us the upper hand.
Well, I've been thinking quite a bit about the baby, she said, smiling and patting her stomach.
He put his hand on hers.
It took us a little while, but I think we're finally figuring out how to survive in the world of politics.
Epilogue. Friday, April 30th, 1954. Washington, D.C. Washington was in mourning. 5 days before, a small plane had crashed in the Blue Ridge Mountains of Virginia and taken the lives of the chairman of the House Appropriations Committee, Representative Franklin Harris Carlin, Republican of Oklahoma, as well as several others, including Charlie's own office manager, Catherine Leopold, and 2 unknown men, presumably the pilot and co-pilot. Their plane had disappeared on the way to Oklahoma. After locating the wreckage, authorities said the bodies had been burned beyond recognition. That was what everyone was told, at any rate. The funeral aired live on local television in Washington, D.C. A camera inside the National Cathedral panned across the faces of the more illustrious guests at the service, Vice President Richard Nixon and his wife Pat, and in the pews behind the Vice President, Senators Kennedy, McCarthy, and Kefauver. House Speaker Joseph Martin and Democratic Leader Sam Rayburn had also been given prominent seats. Charlie watched the proceedings on the television in the West Wing lobby foyer. Originally, he'd planned to attend the funeral, as insincere as that might have been, but an early morning phone call from Ann Whitman, President Eisenhower's personal secretary, forced him to change plans. The funeral made him uncomfortable, not because Charlie had killed Carlin, but because the oratories eulogized an evil and manipulative politician. Then again, Charlie knew, Carlin wouldn't be the first or the last politician so falsely memorialized.
"Pretty creepy to hear all that praise,"
Bernstein whispered to him. He had brought her for the company because neither of them had ever been to the White House and because her internship was soon going to end. In May, she would be heading back home to Los Angeles for a summer job at UCLA. In the fall, she would return to Georgetown for grad school, but it wasn't yet clear if she wanted to continue working in Charlie's office. Her experience had been quite a bit more than she'd expected, and a return to normalcy sounded enticing. The West Wing lobby was filled with men and women darting in and out of offices for appointments with various officials, some sitting on leather chairs and sofas to be greeted, others with special badges, walking around determinedly as if this were Penn Station. Charlie's eyes went everywhere but the television, to fellow visitors, to the black and white checkered marble floor, to the paintings of American history. The work most clearly in his line of sight was the oddest and most disconcerting one in the room. President James Garfield, post-assassination attempt, suffering through his last miserable days on Earth before the infection from the bullet took his life. Snatches of conversations of aides walking by urgently filled the room. "If Secretary Dulles doesn't say Indochina's in the security interests of Southeast Asia, then France will know we ain't sending even one soldier.
The network should be paying McCarthy. I hear ratings are through the roof."
"The Veep gets 1 o'clock shadow. They don't make enough makeup." So Tuscanani freezes. He forgets all the music or something, and the network panics. They cut away. They didn't know what to do.
At least now no one has to pretend that Margaret Truman can sing.
He'd already read every article in the Washington Post on the coffee table in front of him, including the expose on the front page, below the fold, The Curious Case of Phil Strongfellow, in which it was revealed that the U.S. government had no record of the Utah Republican having ever been in the OSS or any other clandestine service. A spokesman for Strongfellow stated that the congressman would be directly appealing to the Eisenhower administration for his war records to be released.
"So what's going to happen to Strongfellow?" Bernstein asked.
"He's over and done," said Charlie. "You see the unnamed Republican congressional aides quoted in the story, saying the party leadership is looking around for someone else to run for the seat in November?"
"Why did he lie?"
"I don't know," Charlie said. "I don't know if he'd be able to explain it either." Charlie wondered whether the Hellfire Club had leaked the information to the Post, or if it had been shared by his dad or his associates, whatever they called themselves. The Post story depicted Strongfellow as either delusional or criminally mendacious. There really wasn't any acceptable explanation. Even the most benign version suggested serious emotional problems. Ann Whitman appeared at the far end of the lobby and spoke to the receptionist, who motioned to Charlie. In her 40s, trim and attractive in a no-nonsense way, the president's secretary strode purposefully toward him.
"Congressman, we're ready for you now," she said.
"You should probably get a cab back to Capitol Hill," Charlie said to Bernstein as he got up to follow Whitman. "I don't know how long this is going to last." Bernstein nodded, stood, and smoothed her dress. She seemed to want to say something, but no words came out. "It's okay, Bernstein. We'll talk more when I get back to the office," he said. She nodded, and Charlie followed Whitman out of the reception area and down the hall to the Oval Office. Charlie had met Eisenhower once before, back in 1948, when the retired general and hero of World War II had been president of Columbia University. Attending a reception honoring students and faculty who had served in the military during the war, Charlie was one of many who stood in line to shake the hand of the former Supreme Commander of the Allied Expeditionary Forces in Europe. At the time, Charlie was pursuing his Ph.D. in American history, and Eisenhower, then 58, was just beginning what would be an ill-fated tenure at the Ivy League school. Their interaction lasted maybe 30 seconds. Handshake, information about the company Charlie had served with, and where. Photograph, thank you for your service. "Come in," the president said now when Whitman knocked on the Oval Office door, his voice as flat as the Kansas plains where he'd been raised. Eisenhower hadn't changed the Oval Office decor much after moving in a year and a half earlier. The walls were gray, and the rug was a blue-green. He'd even stuck with the Teddy Roosevelt desk that Truman had brought out of storage. At the opposite end of the room, an immense floor globe stood before the fireplace, on the mantle of which were 13 miniature flags. To the president's left sat a smaller version of the famous seated Lincoln sculpture. The only touches from the new resident of the office hung on the wall. Photographs of a clean-shaven Abraham Lincoln and a uniformed Confederate General Robert E. Lee were displayed to the president's right, Lincoln slightly higher than the man he had defeated. Across from the president, adjacent to the fireplace, were oil paintings by John James Audubon, one of a woodpecker and one of an oriole. Over the mantle hung a painting of a Pueblo village in New Mexico. Charlie noticed that one painting by the door, a mountain landscape, was signed D.E., the artist, no doubt the man behind the desk, who was busy signing a stack of papers as Charlie walked in. At the edge of Eisenhower's desk was a small display case featuring 24 stones, each taken from a place where he'd once lived, from Fort Sam Houston to Gibraltar. Next to that was a glass block on which was inscribed the Latin phrase, suaviter in modo, fortiter in re, gently in manner, strong in deed. "Have a seat," the president said without looking up. An aide standing next to him handed over and retrieved document after document. "Just need to finish signing these, whatever they are." Charlie regarded the man, who seemed much older than the last time he'd seen him in person. His charisma and likability were unmistakable, but his body was more slope-shouldered, his appearance now more grandfatherly than fatherly. He had defeated Hitler and Hirohito, but he was no match for Father Time. Eisenhower completed the documents, and the aide waited for Eisenhower to dismiss him, which he did, quickly and politely. Now it was just the two of them in the room. Eisenhower took off his glasses and placed them on his desk, then stood up and shook Charlie's hand.
"I'm told we may have met before, at Columbia?"
"Yes, sir," Charlie said. Eisenhower nodded and walked from behind his desk to take a seat on the deep red couch. He invited Charlie to join him in a chair across from him.
"They're about to build a putting green out there for me," Eisenhower said, waving a hand toward the windows. "You golf at all?"
"Poorly and infrequently."
"Ah, well, the rest of us do it poorly and frequently. Your way is probably better."
Charlie grinned. Eisenhower had been his commanding general in France and his college president at Columbia, so he was having difficulty escaping the feeling that he'd done something wrong and had been called to the principal's office.
"Your father tells me you're thinking of returning to academia," the president said, "that it's been something of a bumpy ride here."
Charlie chuckled and then, aware that the president might not understand why, said, "You'll forgive me, sir, but I'm not quite sure how much you know about the past 4 months."
"I know more of it than you probably think I know," he said. "I know you got caught up in this silent war we're in, not the Cold War, though that's part of it, but these factions and associations and clubs, hellfire and such. Not to mention the communists, of course."
"I did, sir. We did, rather. My wife Margaret and myself." Eisenhower looked down at the coffee table, then back up at Charlie.
"I heard of the nasty business with that lobbyist breaking into your house," the president said.
LaMontagne's fall onto the Georgetown street had been impossible to contain or conceal. The martyrs had immediately called the police and reported an intruder. Local newspapers covered it as a D.C. businessman gone mad, and then the FBI took over the investigation.
"And of course I know about the Reds going after your wife," the president added.
2 days earlier, the National Park Service had discovered the decomposing bodies of Gwinnett, Kessler, and Cornelius floating in the ocean. The FBI's official conclusion was that the three academics had drowned because of the powerful storm. They neglected to mention the small detail of the bullet wounds.
"Yes, we've been getting it from all sides," Charlie said.
Eisenhower looked at him thoughtfully.
"You fought in France," he said.
"Yes, sir."
"Our allies in that war very quickly became our enemies. The Chinese snatched half of Korea. The Soviets did the same with Germany. Blink of an eye, everything turned. On my desk when I first walked into this office back in January 1953 was an appeal for executive clemency for the Rosenbergs, which I denied. There are spies. Alger Hiss. Truman's number two at Treasury, Harry White. Dr. Fuchs over in England. I mean, they're there. We don't know how many. Of course, McCarthy is fighting communists in the most un-American way, but the threat is real."
"I know it's real," Charlie said. "The communists tried to kill my wife. And then a few hours later, some anti-communists tried to kill me and my wife."
"And my guys saved you two?"
"Yes, sir. Your guys."
"Charlie, what do you know about the intelligence establishment?" Eisenhower asked.
Just the basics, sir. Need for intel during the war created the OSS, which is now Central Intelligence. Eisenhower chuckled. Well, there's a bit more to it than that. You know, we had practically nothing when I went to Europe. Years before, Secretary of War Stimson had even ended what we had, a tiny code-breaking office. Gentlemen don't read each other's mail, he said. Cripes, can you imagine that? Gentlemen don't read each other's mail. Eisenhower chuckled forlornly. Yes, sir, that sounds hopelessly naive. No one was a fiercer opponent of the OSS continuing after the war than the isolationist wing of our own party, except maybe J. Edgar Hoover, who didn't want the competition. But by now we have a growing intelligence apparatus out there, run by Alan Dulles. I'm confiding in you now, but the truth is, I don't trust how much it's grown. So I, personally, have my own network of folks keeping track of what's going on, reporting to me. Those are my boys, my advisory group, I call them. They don't exist on paper anywhere. They're solely mine. They tell me everything. Your dad is one of them. Street two. There are 36 of them, and they all have their own sources and methods. It's invaluable. Matters are in many ways getting out of hand. Charlie was quiet for a moment, then said, When you say matters are getting out of hand, I'm not sure if you're referring to McCarthy, or the Hellfire Club, or the Reds. Eisenhower greeted Charlie's questioning pause with a stern look. Well, let's discuss these one by one, the president said, since I am now assuming you will be serving on my advisory board. On the first matter, soon enough McCarthy won't be a problem. We already see in public opinion polls that his popularity is plummeting. By the end of this year, it will no longer be McCarthyism. It will be McCarthy-wasm. Permission to speak freely, sir? Charlie asked. The president smiled. Permission granted, soldier. Charlie collected his thoughts. Watching the U.S. Army McCarthy drama had been nerve-wracking. It felt as though the nation's tolerance for indecency and lies would never reach a limit. He had watched as senators he'd previously respected pretended that the unacceptable wasn't becoming the status quo. He feared McCarthy would keep rising in popularity and status, leaving in his wake the complete destruction of basic societal norms. The historian in him intellectually suspected that something at some point would stop McCarthy. All great tyrants experience downfalls, but he couldn't see it coming for Tail Gunner Joe. He tried to take some small comfort in the president's confidence that the end was near, but he needed to know more. Sir, how can you be so sure? The president took a second to consider his reply. I am sure because I am confident in the idea of the United States of America, Charlie, he finally said. I believe that the combination of checks and balances in a free press and our democratically elected representatives ultimately will expose charlatans. I believe in the good sense of the American people, and I know in my soul that truth will win out. Permission to speak freely again, sir? Granted, said Eisenhower. That's a nice speech, but I assume there's more to it than your faith in the American people. There is, Eisenhower said. We've set a perfect trap for him, just as we did the Germans with Operation Fortitude. I am convinced that the only person who can destroy McCarthy as a political figure is McCarthy himself. And he has many weaknesses. One of them is drink. Another is Cone. And Cone's weakness is Private Shine. McCarthy and Cone demanded special treatment for Shine last year. It was denied. So now McCarthy is going after the Army. That's a fight he cannot win. And it's a fight we are prepared for. He will not walk out of the hearings on the Army unscathed. Charlie considered what the president was saying. He would have to take it on faith. There are others, of course, who are ripping apart our country in the name of preserving it, Charlie said. It's not just McCarthy. Eisenhower looked away toward his painting of a mountain landscape. The main characteristic of the 7 years between VE Day and my moving into this office has been the steady consolidation of power in two blocks facing off against each other, he said, with a growing arsenal of enormously destructive weapons on both sides. Chemical weapons being one facet of that, Charlie said. One of many, Eisenhower frowned. Part of understanding everything at play in Washington right now is understanding the birth of a multi-billion dollar industry. Do you know that the amount of money our government spends on military security every year is greater than the net income of all U.S. corporations? It's astounding. We need a strong defense, of course, but I'm concerned about the conjunction of an immense military establishment with this large arms industry. It's new in the American experience. The total influence is felt everywhere. every town, every village, every congressional vote. The arms manufacturers won't make as much money if we're at peace, Charlie noted.
Precisely.
When our wars are determined not by the threat of Nazism or fascism or communism, but by the influence on policymakers of those who stand to reap financial benefits from the use of these arms, that, Charlie, is my biggest fear for this country. We have, for the first time in the history of this great nation, a war-based industry that exists even though we are not at war. Officers leave the military and take jobs in this industry and influence policies. We don't want to become what the communists say we are. He stared at Charlie, his ice-blue eyes projecting seriousness and concern.
And that's one of the reasons why I need you to stay in Congress, Charlie, the president continued, because you understand both the threat of the communists and the threat of those who would destroy the United States in order to save it.
There was a knock at the door, and Mrs. Whitman poked her head in.
Just give me 2 more minutes, Annie, the president said.
He stood and walked back to his desk.
Sir?
Charlie asked.
We need men like you, Charlie. The Republican Party does, Congress does, and more important, the nation does. I need you working for us the way that your dad and your colleague Mr. Street do, for me, as my eyes and ears, one of my soldiers.
As Eisenhower sat, Charlie stood.
Soon the nation will be waging wars just to bring up stock prices, the president said. The Hellfire Club, as you well know, has been around for centuries, and they've generally kept their business private, but recently its members have been flexing their muscles in ways that are getting people killed. Look at the banana man, what's his name, from United Fruit Company.
Sam Zemurray, Charlie said.
Right,
said Eisenhower.
In Guatemala, I can't tell what I'm being pushed to do because of the communists and what I'm being pushed to do because Zemurray doesn't want to pay his banana pickers a living wage. And while he's not a member, the Hellfire Club doesn't admit Jews, he wields huge influence with a few of the monks, Alan Dulles and Foster, both. So I need my own eyes and ears all over the place. I trust Alan Dulles, but I need to know what he's up to. If he and his brother are continuing to take money from Zemurray, for instance.
Now Charlie felt less reassured. If even Eisenhower was this confused about agendas, what hope could he possibly have of understanding it?
Don't give up the fight, Eisenhower said. We need brave people like you and your wife, people who are willing to do the right thing. Heroes. Heroes like your dad and Congressman Street. That's how we defeat enemies, foreign and domestic, with men and women of character.
All Charlie could think about were the moments since he'd come to Washington when he was not brave, when options were put in front of him and he had decidedly not done the right thing. He hadn't gone to the cops immediately after waking up in Rock Creek. He'd passed the Boschwitz file over to Bob Kennedy, swiped the NBC documents about Strongfellow from his dad's office and handed them over to Roy Cohn. He had done what was most comfortable and advantageous for himself, nothing more. Here was the president, suggesting he was on the path of the righteous because midway through it he'd snapped out of his stupor and worked with Margaret and Isaiah on a plan to rebel. And somehow they'd all survived. He wanted to ask Eisenhower about this. Did all heroes feel like such frauds? What had Charlie done after all? Killed Carlin and helped Street save Margaret. She was healthy and would soon give birth, and the doctor reported that the baby looked great too, and that was the most important thing. But the CEO of General Kinetics was fat and happy manufacturing his poisons, and the Hellfire Club was down one monk but still thriving and pulling strings. Nothing had really changed, except he and Margaret were not immediately being threatened. But McCarthy and Cohn and Abner Lance were still out there. His father had told him that Alan Dulles had sworn that Charlie and Margaret were safe for now, but how long would that last?
I feel as though I have failed this nation more than I have fought for it, sir, Charlie said,
since coming here to Washington anyway. Eisenhower looked grimly down at his desk.
Charlie, the president began.
He stood and stared out the window.
In October 1952, I was campaigning in Wisconsin, Milwaukee. I was going to give a speech, and in it, I planned to stand up for my friend General Marshall. McCarthy had been smearing him as a traitor for the better part of a year. I was very excited. I had a section in the speech vouching for my friend's patriotism, and I would do so in Milwaukee, with McCarthy on stage. It would be a moment I could feel proud of.
He exhaled, and the life seemed to go out of him. He turned and put his hands on the back of his chair.
Then the governor got his hands on a copy of my speech, and he convinced my aides that they should take out that section, that if I stood up for George Marshall, I might alienate McCarthy, which could cost me Wisconsin's electoral votes.
There was another knock at the Oval Office door, and Mrs. Whitman once again poked her head in. The president turned to her.
One more second,
he said. She closed the door. Eisenhower paused, apparently trying to find his place in the story.
So what did you do after you heard that the governor told your aides to take out that section? Charlie asked, attempting to help.
I had them take it out of my speech, Eisenhower said. I wish I hadn't. And this ended up, of course, not being the last time I had to defer to the egoism of this demagogue. McCarthy kept coming and coming and coming at me. My Secretary of the Army has been trying to accommodate him. That hasn't stopped him. He is incapable of stopping, even when it's in his own interests. Smearing and lying, it's what he does. One cannot appease the insatiable.
And as it turned out, you didn't need Wisconsin's electoral votes, Charlie noted.
And it turned out I didn't need the electoral votes, Eisenhower agreed.
He smiled at Charlie, a sad smile tinged with regret.
Okay, soldier. Dismissed,
Eisenhower said, extending a hand to shake Charlie's.
Take care of that pregnant little lady of yours.
Charlie thanked the president and walked out of the Oval Office in the West Wing. It was a gorgeous spring day, sunny but with a cool breeze rising from the Potomac River. Grape hyacinth and tulips decorated the north lawn. Men in dark suits and skinny ties and young women with tight blouses and high heels walked with determination to and from the building. Outside the White House grounds, across Pennsylvania Avenue, Margaret sat in the driver's seat of the parked car, waiting for him. He walked around to the passenger side and got in.
So where to? Margaret asked. Capitol Hill? Back to Manhattan? Somewhere else entirely?
Her face was glowing with possibility and trust and partnership. She grinned at him expectantly, her eyes sparkling with joy. Charlie put his hand on Margaret's swelling belly and smiled.
Wherever you want the road to take us, he said.
This has been a Hachette audio production of The Hellfire Club. Written and read by Jake Tapper. Produced and directed by Cheryl Smith. Recorded by Adam Ruhner. Post-production by Danny Meltzer. The Hellfire Club is also available in print and digital formats from Little Brown & Company, a division of Hachette Book Group. For more Hachette audio productions, visit us at hachetteaudio.com. Thank you for listening. Text copyright 2018 by Jake Tapper. Audio production copyright 2018, Hachette Audio, all rights reserved. Hachette Book Group supports the right to free expression and the value of copyright. The purpose of copyright is to encourage writers and artists to produce the creative works that enrich our culture. The duplicating, uploading, and distribution of this audiobook without permission is a theft of the author's intellectual property. If you would like permission to use material from the audiobook other than for review purposes, please contact permissions at hbgusa.com. Thank you for your support of the author's rights. This audiobook is a work of fiction. Names, characters, places, and incidents are either the product of the author's imagination or are used fictitiously, and any resemblance to actual persons, living or dead, events or locales, is entirely coincidental.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.